Hi everyone. Hi everyone. I'm so pleased to have you here attending our SAIS Distinguished Lecture. So I am Dilma da Silva. I'm the Division Director for Communication and Computing and Communication Foundations, and I'm here the host today. I'll give you a very brief introduction to our speaker. We think it's much better that he will tell more as he sees fit. So Sumiti Gowan is the distinguished scientist and vice president at Microsoft, where he spearheads scientific advancements in AI technology and their integration into mass market products. So Sumit, this sounds really like a very interesting job. So maybe people can even ask more about it later on if we have time. So feel free to start. Thank you so much for being here.
Yes, thank you, Dilma, for this opportunity. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone who is joining in. So back in 1995, when I was picking colleges, I had two options: pick electrical engineering at IIT Kanpur, which was closer to my hometown, or study computer science in a different IIT. Now, I loved programming, but the desire to stay closer to parents was stronger. And I thought I could self-teach myself programming. So I ended up picking electrical engineering at IIT Kanpur. So in the first year, in one of our intro programming courses, the instructor told us that we can multiply two 2x2 matrices using seven multiplications instead of eight. Now that sounded very intriguing, and I wondered, how can you do that? Now at that time, there was no Google and much less ChatGPT. So I went back to the instructor and asked them, how is this possible? And you know what the instructor responded? So they said that this premium material is meant only for CS students. And that upset me enough to rewrite the joint entrance examination and get myself admitted to study computer science at IIT Kanpur. And not only that, I followed it up with a PhD in computer science at UC Berkeley. And then after I got trained as a scientist and I started my job at Microsoft Research, one of the first problems that I decided to tackle was how you can automatically synthesize such tricky programs, say by searching over the state space of all possible programs of a given size. And it took me 5 years to get my revenge when we had a paper that could do just that. And in fact, one of the enabling technologies here was an ability to verify the correctness of such programs in the first place. And that's why the paper is titled From Program Verification to Program Synthesis. So this paper that appeared in Popple 2010 also received the Most Influential Paper Award in 2020. And in fact, life has come back a full circle for me when my alma mater told me 4 weeks ago that I'm being honored with the Distinguished Alumnus Award for all of my program synthesis work that followed since then. And this is the journey that I will share in this talk. Now, I'm so glad that ChatGPT didn't exist at that time, because today, if you were to just specify this in natural language, it will actually give you this program of how to multiply 2x2 matrices using seven multiplications instead of it. And not only this, ChatGPT can give you many other programs and algorithms. In fact, it can even give you a way to multiply two 2x2 matrices using six multiplications, which is mathematically impossible. Now, this is the challenge with such technologies, that they can hallucinate even when they don't know how to do a certain task. And maybe this is time for us to go back to program verification, program synthesis, so that we can validate the results of these large language models. And in this talk, I'm going to touch a little bit on this. But if we can do that, we not only get reliability, maybe this is the way for us to also discover new algorithms that we do not know yet. So once I was actually returning from a seminar on program synthesis, this was in 2009, after presenting this algorithm that I described to you, from program verification to program synthesis. And there was a lady sitting next to me in the plane. She was very impressed to know that I have a PhD in computer science and that I work for Microsoft Research and that I work on automated programming. So she thought that maybe I could help her with something that she was struggling with. So she opens up her laptop, fires up Excel, and shows me a column of names and asks me, how can she reformat these names by giving me an example? Now, at that time, I had no idea about the programming model underneath Excel. So I had to excuse myself out of the situation. But after I got back home, I tried to look for a solution to this problem. And it is then that I observed that many, many people struggled with simple repetitive tasks like these. And this inspired me to develop the flash fill feature in Excel, where if you give one example of the transformation that you want to do, and then press Control E, the system will generalize your example into a program and run that program to automate the task for you. And the enabling breakthrough here was the ability to automatically synthesize such programs very efficiently, and just from one or more examples. Now, let me tell you a little bit about how this algorithm works. So FlashFill searches for programs in an underlying domain-specific language. And in this case, the language consists of a typical string algebra that has operators like substring or concatenate. Now, one way to search for programs in a domain-specific language might be to enumerate all programs in order of increasing size and see which one fits the examples that the user has provided. But this algorithm is not going to scale because even this DSL has too many programs to enumerate. So the real heart of the FlashFill algorithm is a technique to do symbolic backpropagation of examples over the structure of the ground. And this process also sometimes leads to multiple goals at each recursive step. So what we can do is to explore those goals in the order of their likelihood to succeed. And this can be done using machine learning techniques. And it sometimes even gives us a 10x speeder. So at the end of this process, we end up with many, many programs that satisfy the examples that the user has provided. And we need to pick now one of those programs. And this is done using ranking techniques. So we can rank programs based upon how simple or small the program is. And another thing that we figured out was also to leverage output features. Features of the output obtained from executing the program on other inputs. So if one program ends up generating outputs that look more or less uniform, then that program should be preferred. Now this technique has also stood the test of time. And this Popple 2011 paper also received the most influential paper award at the Popple 2021 instance. And the idea of leveraging a domain-specific language is now also finding its use with LLMs as well. So I use DSLs for efficiency, but with LLMs, DSLs are quite important to ensure that the output from these models adheres to some syntactic or semantic constraints. In fact, in August 2024, OpenAI released an API to allow you to actually do that. And in fact, this entire paradigm of first generating lots of programs and then ranking them using some extra signals is also very common with LLMs today. Now, FlashWell became very popular. And my sister, who parents are middle schooler, figured out that FlashWell made it into middle school computing textbooks. But you know what my most heartening accolade was? It came from my father, who told me that, son, now I understand your research for the first time. So sadly, my father passed away a couple of years ago, but he had a big influence on my scientific journey. He always used to nag me, how does your research help common people? And that was perhaps my inspiration to get started on this line of work. Now, FlashWell can automate a wide variety of tasks. You know, that's why it's so popular. But there are also many tasks that it cannot do, such as date transformations or number transformations. But the user experience is so inviting that it doesn't prevent people from trying it on tasks that it was never meant for. So there was this tweet that went viral where someone gave an example mapping DEC to December, and then the system maps OCT to October. Now, some people even came to my rescue by saying maybe this is how we should have named months in the first place. I even came across this shipping label where someone likely incorporated FlashWell as part of their process automation. But you know, the beautiful thing about this kind of feedback is that it helps inspire the next scientific problems that you might want to go solve. And this is exactly what we did. So the next version of FlashWell that we have built actually supports such date and number transformations. For instance, look at the task here where in column A, you have a string and the user wants to extract the year and the month out of it and then convert it into the year quarter format as you see on the right side in column B. And this new system can infer the right transformation from a couple of examples. And not only that, it will also give you a readable formula in various languages, such as Python, or in this case, the Excel formula language. In fact, this was one of the most common asks from FlashWell users because they would like to get some transparency into the underlying process. So this functionality ships as the formula by example feature in Excel Copilot. One of the videos from an Excel influencer that I saw talked about how they find that this is 10x better than FlashWell. And we often talk about 10x expressions. So this was very heartening to see. My most favorite tagline in a video that was made for this feature is the one on the bottom right here, where someone very explicitly says that this is not ChatGPT. So how does this technology work? So what we did was we extended the FlashWell language to include date and number transformations and many stylized ways of doing string transformations so that we can generate good readable programs. But the big challenge when you extend the DSL is that it leads to scalability issues. So we had to come up with some very interesting optimizations that combine the top-down search process that FlashWell uses with some hints from bottom-up search as well. So if you're interested in reading a recent AI paper that is not ChatGPT, so this one in Power 2023 would be it. Now, one question that you might ask is, why not use ChatGPT for these kinds of tasks? And actually, it's a great suggestion because ChatGPT has a lot of worldly knowledge. And if you ask it, you know, if DEC goes to December, it will actually tell you that OCT goes to October. And in fact, this was the title of my entire keynote that I gave at CAV last summer. But I will just summarize it in, you know, one slide. So GPT-3 can actually do syntactic transformations of the kind that you see here, where you want to extract the first three characters from the month name. However, its bias about the real world knowledge is so strong that if you ask it to extract the first four characters, it cannot even learn to do that even from four examples. It will not get it right. But if you were to give this task to GPT-4, it will get this right. But if you ask it to extract the first 5 characters, then it fails to do that one. And maybe GPT-5 will probably solve this problem. Now, over the last year, you know, after giving the talk, we have been investigating more closely why is it that the LLMs are not so great at programming by example problems, and what can we do to have them solve these problems more effectively? So this is what we figured out. That programming by example actually requires you to predict the execution semantics of a given program. And we know that LLMs are not very good at doing arithmetic operations, for instance. But the way to do arithmetic is to have them generate number sentences. And the same kind of phenomenon also extends to more complicated operations that we have in programming languages. And the trick here is to actually show the execution results to the model as it is decoding its output. And I'll show you how this works on the next slide. And the other challenge in programming by examples is that once you have a tricky task where you're manipulating some dirty data and you need 2 or more examples, then it is not really a translation kind of problem as you would normally have from natural language. It is really more of a search problem because you want to find the common logic that works for multiple examples. And here the idea is that let LLM, you know, do the search. So let's see how we can do that. So here I have a task where I want to extract the last name of the author from some bibliographic entries. And if I give these 4 examples to GPT-4, it gives me a program which doesn't really do the right job. And as you can see in the last column, it makes some errors. So what can we do instead? So here is the main idea. So as GPT-4 is generating the program line by line, so you take control back after it has generated a line, and you augment that with the execution semantics of that line on the various inputs that you have in the examples. And now GPT-4 is able to see what is the effect of this program sentence that it has emitted. And then you give the control back to GPT-4. It will output another line. You augment it back with the execution of that line. And as this process continues, you know, you stop when you hit the outputs in the examples that you have. And this actually gives you the correct result. Now, in the very same methodology, you can also employ another extremely powerful idea, which is that instead of asking the GPT-4 to give you 1 candidate for the next line, you ask it to generate multiple candidates for the next line. And then you can combine all of those candidates together as 1 program segment and add it to the program. And now the model can decide which of these lines it wants to use for its further computation downstream. So this is a very simple way to convert LLM into a search engine. Okay. So what you've seen up till now is examples being a very effective modality for doing string transformations. So it turns out there are other kinds of tasks also which are amenable to example-based intent specification. I'll show you an instance of table extraction next. So here is a task taken from a data science class where the instructor asks the students to take a semi-structured text file that you see here and convert it into a proper CSV format. And the instructor provides the students a script to build on top of. Now let me show you how this experience can be made much more delightful using programming by example interface. So this is the same file that I've loaded in my playground. And now all that I do is to give you examples of the various fields I want to extract. So let's say I want to extract the championship name. So I select 1 example, and then I highlight another instance of that field. And after I provide 2 instances, the system is smart enough now to learn a program and use that program to extract other instances of that field efficiently from this file. Now, suppose I want to extract a different field, say the year, I give 1 example, And now one example suffices for the underlying system to infer my intent. Now let's say I also want to extract the winning score. So when I give one example, the system actually makes a mistake in the third record here because it's in a different format. Now I can fix this example. I can give the right output for the third row, and the system will then converge to the intent that I have in mind. But what if this mistake was somewhere deep within your long file? In fact, if you are programming it yourself, you know, all bets are off because you might not even notice that such a mistake actually occurred, and you might get wrong results in your analysis. But in case of programming by example, there's something very beautiful that you can do. So you take top ranked programs that a system has generated from a few examples, and you run all of them in parallel and see if they have a discrepancy in their outputs on some future record. And if so, you point that out to the user. So in this case, if you take the top two ranked programs and run them, you will notice that those programs actually produce different outputs on record three. And this is exactly what you show to the user. And you ask the user, do you want this output or the other output or something else? And in this case, no, I want something else, which is 16-7. And when I do that, I actually get the correct results. So again, this technology works exactly along the same methodology that I showed you for flash fill, except that the domain specific language is different here. But what the demonstration showed was the importance of helping the user identify the right examples, especially when the data might be dirty and it might be big. And this idea of asking the user, oh, on this row 37, do you mean output one or output two, or do you want to provide another output, is taken from this paper on distinguishing inputs, which also received the most influential paper award recently. And there are other ways to also help people figure out potential discrepancies by analyzing the patterns in the input row or even patterns in the output that is generated from picking some specific program. So this demonstration that I showed you over custom text files can also be applied to semi-structured documents of different kinds, such as web pages, PDF, JSON, and so forth. And many of these technologies actually ship as data connectors inside a Microsoft product called Power BI. And they've been ranked as top connectors in surveys. But the most interesting thing we figured out was that these technologies had very high usage during COVID times, when people would try to mash up different messy data sets to build up important dashboards. Okay, now let me move on to a different way of expressing intent. So when we build these data connectors, these technologies for extracting tables, the product team challenged us and told us that, oh, we don't have time to build these rich user experiences that you're talking about. Can you actually do such table extraction tasks from zero examples? And I thought they had gone crazy, because even giving 1 to 2 examples, you know, such a tremendous boost for the user as opposed to writing the entire parsing script. But how on earth can you do it with zero examples? But when I thought more about it, I realized that if I show you a semi-structured document, you can pretty much figure out what the various fields are. You don't need to provide me one or two examples of the various tens of fields that might be there in the document. So this is what inspired us to develop technologies that can understand the user's intent for the underlying table by just looking at the raw table and without requiring the users to give some examples. So let me show you an experience of what might be possible with these technologies. So this is a video recorded by my colleague, Arjun.
I'm looking at a table in a PDF here. This one is about rice production. I don't know much about agriculture, but I do know a lot about the pain of pasting PDF tables into Excel. We get all the data into one column, and it's a huge pain fixing it. Here we have OmniTable, which is a clipboard extension built on top of Pro's ingestion technology. And look at that, OmniTable has done the right thing. And why just text from PDFs? You can directly copy PDFs from the file explorer, and OmniTable will read and parse the file. I really like this case, as it has figured out that the last bits of the page are shaped differently, and it's handled it really well. But PDFs are just the beginning. OmniTable can handle many formats, web pages, malformed CSVs, JSON files, and many other textual formats. Here is me copying a list of movies from IMDb that I want to watch later. And it's figured out all the right details automatically. And here's one case where I'm trying to figure out what concerts I can see this summer. And the web page here is not even formatted as a table, but OmniTable has identified some tabular data inside, and the table that was pasted is exactly what I wanted. Tables are everywhere, but copying tabular data is currently hard and convoluted. OmniTable can act as a bridge that makes this process easier.
So you can see how such technologies can enable a smart copy-paste experience now. And the key idea here is to actually infer and guess the examples which the user is not providing anymore, and then use programming by example techniques. And today, if the data is quite noisy, we can actually even use LLMs, which understand the semantics of the real world, to actually infer what these examples might even be. But now let me actually show you another way where the user can express intent through temporal context. So what you saw was a spatial context, but sometimes the user's intent is also hidden inside temporal context as to what they have been doing in the recent past. So suppose I'm watching a class and I have written this. Now I can let Copilot take over and it will actually complete the code for me, right? So very impressive stuff. But what if I'm working on this code fragment? It would be hard for someone to guess what my intent here would be. However, what if you observe what I was doing a few minutes ago? So I had this other program segment where I replaced an expression that was converting Fahrenheit into centigrade by a call to a new method that I've just defined. And then I do a similar kind of refactoring at another place. And if you saw me doing this, then you can potentially guess what I want to do in the bottom code fragment, which is to do a similar conversion. So this is called learning the user's intent from temporal context. And the way you do this is that the user provides some examples, and then the programming by example synthesizer will learn a transformation program for doing such code transformations. And then you apply this program to give the user what they want. So let me show you the first experience that we designed around such a technology. So there are four boxes, and the user copies and pastes all the expressions they want to transform in the top left box. Then they give me an example of the transformation in the two bottom boxes. And then they press the magic button, and all the expressions, you know, get transformed appropriately. But there's a big problem with this user experience because it involves a lot of window switches and copy paste. And in fact, an in-the-flow user would not even realize to use such a tool when they start doing the task manually. And I guarantee you that if this is the experience we released, people would not really have used this functionality. So what do we do instead? So this team t-shirt shows, you know, our solution. And the idea is to watch constantly what the user is doing. And from their potentially noisy sequence of keystrokes, we try to infer any repetitive examples. And once we find those instances, then we produce suggestions for the transformation from those examples. Now, this looks a bit like Clippy, because the tool is always going to hand raise and give you suggestions about what you want to do next. And you don't want this to become Clippy for code. So for instance, if the user changes, you know, two integers to strings, you don't want to suggest to the user to replace all instances of integer to a string. People will lose trust in your feature and will turn off your feature. In fact, this is what happened with an initial release of this functionality. And we learned the hard way that it is very important to strike the right precision recall trade-off and do the right ranking of the underlying suggestions. And for this, we used many different signals, even including where the user's cursor location was. With that, we went from people writing posts on how to turn off this feature to a lot of social media love. But let me actually share with you my most heartening accolade for this functionality. So I'm going to play a video from the Ability Summit at Microsoft, where you get to hear about the pains that this developer has, the challenges that she has.
See, one in four computer users will develop a chronic overuse injury. Having one hand just means I ran into it twice as fast. Suddenly, every click sent pins and needles shooting up my arm. From the minute I woke up to the moment I fell asleep, if I could fall asleep, the pain would not stop. I tried switching to using my shoulders and my nub more to type, and my wrist got a little bit better. But 6 months later, I developed chronic tendonitis in both of my shoulders. By that point, my arms were so bad I couldn't wash my own hair or hold a cup. And every doctor I saw agreed that the root of the problem was the thing I loved the most, my computer. Career computer use requires a lot of repetitive gestures, I learned. More than any one part of the human body is designed to do long term. A paraplegic who uses voice control will develop vocal strain. We've all probably met someone in our field whose hands or lower back hurts at the end of the workday, or hurts it. And some of it helped a little, but no matter what mouse you use, you still have to click it.
Okay, now let me fast forward to the segment where she talks
But
about
now I have to repeat this 10 more.
a couple of features that she uses every day that have helped alleviate the pain that she goes through.
Times. Ugh. But look at what happens now. I do that edit a second time, and on the third time, IntelliCode is going to do something amazing. It automatically suggests that same edit on the next line. Then, if I press the preview all shortcut, are you seeing this? It applies the edit to every spot in my file that matches that pattern. And lets me take all of those edits by just pressing tab. For me, this is huge. It took fewer gestures to edit 10 lines than it would take to just get the cursor onto the next line without IntelliCode. And while this is great for me because typing is physically difficult, if you have a focus-based disability like ADHD, a tool like this could help you stay on track. Another spot us developers get bogged down in is
So I hope this inspired you to consider developing AI technologies for also enhancing accessibility as opposed to only focusing on productivity. Now let me move on to the part of my talk where we will talk about a different way that the user expresses intent, not through examples, not through natural language, but by doing the task themselves and then expecting AI to assist them to fix what might have potentially gone wrong. So one common complaint that we often see on Excel help forums is people will share the formulas that they have and the errors that it leads to when they try to run the formula. And then they request an expert on the help forum to help them fix this formula. Now, in many cases, the formula is just a little bit away from being correct, a small edit distance away. But the syntax is often very cryptic and the compiler error message not very helpful. However, the expert is often able to look at this and provide the right fix. And we call this the problem of last mile repair. So we thought if the expert can do such fixes, maybe we can also develop an AI technology to do these fixes. So in this case, the fix is, just inserting these two characters that you see at the bottom. So here is how our workflow looks like. So given the red buggy formula, we do some enumeration of all potential local repairs, small local repairs to the buggy formula. And to speed up this process, we leverage a neural module, which predicts where the error might be in the first place. And then once we get a bunch of repairs, potential repairs, we use another ML module to rank these repairs, and then we pick the top one and show it to the user. Now, let me talk about a very important application domain for program repair. And this is an area that has not yet been disrupted by AI, the area of education. So the picture that you see here is not a stock picture. It is actually taken by a colleague at Cornell. These are the students waiting in the corridors of the office hours of an intro programming course. And the line extends around the corner. And you know what the last student is thinking? Will I get a few minutes with the TA to discuss the doubts that I have? I think the big challenge with education has been that we are still stuck with the centuries-old model where one teacher is teaching 30 students in a classroom and students are not able to get personalized feedback. In fact, the demand for programming courses is 5 times more than the availability, and often due to lack of TAs. Another sad statistic that we see is that an 80% dropout amongst US minority students, likely because the tech stack is not adequate. What students need is not a sample solution, but feedback on how their broken solution, which reflects their thought process, can be extended into a correct solution. And I think we have a huge opportunity at our hands right now to develop a technology that can give feedback to students just like a human TA would give by progressively revealing different kinds of hints. We have decades of work in program analysis and verification. And now we're already seeing a disruption that large language models have brought with respect to how good they are at programming. And we have the potential to fine-tune these models with the students' learning journeys. Because the students all across the world, year after year, are struggling with the similar kinds of confusions. And this data can be collected to actually fine-tune these models. So let me show you some work that we have done in this space. So what you see here is an incorrect program for the palindrome problem from the student. It has all different kinds of errors, syntax errors, semantic errors, and we're able to fix all of them, as you see in the second column. And this fix does not happen in just one call to the LLM, but we do these fixes in an iterative manner, just like how the student would have probably done it themselves. So first we fix syntax errors, and we do that one by one, because fixing a syntax error can lead to change in the next set of errors that you might have to fix. And then once the program can execute, we look at the semantic discrepancy on some test cases that might be available and ask the LLM to consider making similar changes in the student's code. And then once we get multiple candidates from the LLM, we pick the one that is closest to the student solution. So similar kinds of process can actually lead to fixing the student's code. But the interesting thing is that the students do not really need a fix to their submitted code. What they need are hints that will help increase their learning, enhance their learning experiences. So let me show you the work that we did recently in order to provide some good hints to students. And this will also be a good exercise into showing some tricks around prompt engineering. So we asked the LLM to give a short hint to the student, and we describe what a hint should be. It should not be too detailed so that the student is able to think, and it should not be too abstract so that it is constructive. But just asking the LLM to provide a hint to a student's buggy solution is not very effective. So for instance, this is a broken program from the student, which has this error. And if you ask GPT-4 to generate a hint here, it will actually give you something that is not very meaningful. So one trick is to enhance the prompt here with respect to asking the model to do some chain of thought reasoning. And the way you do that is by asking the model to actually first describe the bug in detail and the fix, and use that to actually generate this hint, which is not very concealing. But even before generating the fix, we pass in more information, such as the failing test case, and probably even a fixed version of the buggy program that was computed using the technology that I showed you earlier. So with this kind of prompt augmentation, the tool is now able to generate the right hint. And now if you look at the results, we went from 66% precision to 82% precision. But this is still not a good number for this tool to be deployed in classrooms, because you would likely not send your child to a teacher that is only 82% correct. You want the accuracy to be much higher in 90s. So let me show you what we did in order to increase the precision. And the trick is to actually reduce the recall. And the idea is to understand what might be needed to prevent bad hints from being shown to the student. So our key insight there is that we ask the model to take the feedback that was generated by the model and use that feedback to fix the buggy program. So in some sense, model is going to be simulating the student. And since we are focusing on only one bug, we ask the model to resolve the remaining bugs by itself so that we can then check whether the fix that the system did by looking at that explanation was actually a correct fix or not. However, the model might be too smart and might be able to still generate the right fix, even if the explanation is bad. And the trick here is to provide an escape mechanism to the model to point out if the explanation is indeed bad, as opposed to just trying to look at that explanation and still trying to fix the program. And then we use a less powerful model for doing this. So hints are generated using GPT-4, but whether that hint was good enough or not is tested using GPT-3.5. And since the process might be stochastic, what we do is we run n different trials, and then we say a hint is good only if a certain fraction of these trials lead to success. And furthermore, we also see what the effect is if the hint is not shown to GPT-3.5. And in this case, we require that the delta between when the hint is shown and not shown is again significant. And once you go through this workflow, we find that the performance really boosts up a lot, close to 95% precision at the cost of reducing recall. And here's a table that shows the importance of each and every trick that I showed you. So if you don't use one of those tricks, you know, the performance will actually drop down. Okay. Now let me talk about the last application in the case of repair. And this is for helping developers debug their code. Debugging is one of the most time-consuming tasks for developers. So over the last year, we have brought in Copilot support to assist developers with debugging their code. So now when you get a runtime exception in your code, you will see this option to ask Copilot, where Copilot will give you an explanation of the potential error in your code and also suggest a fix. So let me show you what was the first solution that we built for such a functionality. So like everyone else, we focused on doing prompt engineering and putting in all kind of debugging information as context for the LLM. And we noticed that there was only 25% success rate around our user study. And the reason for this was that Copilot was trying to leap towards providing a fix to the user, even when it did not know what the real error was. So it would make wrong assumptions and will try to quickly close the conversation with the user by saying, this is how you should actually fix it. And this again gets back to the problem of hallucinations. If the model does not know something, it has been trained to still respond. So there's one very simple but powerful idea that you can use to prevent this from happening or to lower the chances of this happening. So instead of asking the model, give me a fix to this buggy program, you ask the model, do you know the answer to this challenge? Do you know what the issue might be? And do you know the fix to this problem? And if the model says, no, I do not need any more investigation, I know how to solve it, then you let it get back to the user. But if the model says, yes, I need to do some more investigation, then you ask the model, do you need to involve the user and have some interaction with the user? And if the model says no, then let the model figure out this more information from the context and repeat this process. Or you go to the user and ask some questions of the user in a collaborative way to help the user figure out this issue. So with this kind of agentic workflow, we were able to get much better performance for debugging tasks. So this Gantt diagram shows the effect of using this agentic pattern versus using the vanilla Copilot chat experience on various tasks that we give to the developer. So on the right side, what you would notice is that there are more solid bars as opposed to slanted bars, indicating more use of these technologies by the users. And another interesting thing that you will notice on the right side is that the blue bars occur before the green bars, meaning that the tool is first trying to localize the problems working with the developer and then trying to provide a fix, as opposed to just leaping to a fix without even figuring out properly what might be wrong. And this leads to 88% success, which is big, you know, compared to the baseline of 25%. And here are some verbatims. And my favorite is the second one that we got from one of the users in the user study, where the user says that now they feel more empowered to be able to resolve a similar issue on their own. So you can see that these kinds of experiences can also aid learning experiences for people. Okay, so this is the last segment of my talk, where I will talk about the most common form of intent, which is natural language. It's very versatile, and today LLMs can even interpret it. However, if this natural language utterance is about a task that the LLM does not know how to do well, because it probably has not seen much of a training data, then one fascinating capability that these large language models offer is their ability for in-context learning. And this can be facilitated by giving a good example or some good part of the documentation to the model. So this is some space that my team has been doing some work recently, and I'll share some insights from there. Now, suppose I want to convert this natural language utterance on the left side into the SQL code fragment on the right side. Now, when we were trying this task using GPT-3, we figured out it could not do that. So the trick was, what kind of example can we pick from our example bank so that the model can actually do this translation? And the most intuitive idea is to pick an example from the example bank whose natural language part of the input is very similar to the natural language that the user has provided. But if you do that, in this case, you will notice that the model actually gives you the wrong output because it refers to a column that does not exist. Instead, there is another example in our database, in our example bank, where the code part of the example, the output part of the example, is actually very similar to the output that we desired on the right side. And if we pass this example instead, then the model can do this task. And now the challenge is, how on earth will you figure out that you should pick this example at the bottom as opposed to the one at the top? And the trick there is to simply fine-tune the model, right? Fine-tune this sentence word model to redefine the similarity of two utterances to match the similarity of their respective code. And to make this process efficient, you want to only pick those examples where natural language similarity is high, but code similarity is low, because those are the things you want to unlearn, or it is the other way around, and these are the things that you want to learn, as opposed to picking out all quadratic pairs of examples, which might be very expensive. And then one other optimization that we did later on was to replace the sentence BERT by the embeddings layer of these large language models, which will allow you to even handle out of distribution language, because these models are very strong in their language understanding abilities. And you simply fine tune by adding few dense layers at the end of these embeddings. Now, one interesting optimization relates to how do we define code similarity. So in this scenario, I want to map this natural language utterance to this expression that you see on the right side. But this one is actually incorrect because it is not using the right regular expression syntax. What we really want is the one that you see at the bottom, where you have dot dot. Now, I might have two examples in my example bank. The one at the top is actually very close to the intended output that you see on the bottom right. You just have to replace one comma by dot dots. And if you define code similarity based on edit distance, this is the example you will likely end up picking, but then it will not really help. Instead, if you pick the example at the bottom, then it works out. But now, to pick the example at the bottom, the important thing is that code similarity should not be defined based on edit distance, but based on some properties, such as what method name is being used, or whether or not a regular expression is being used or not. And the advantage of using properties for defining code similarity is that it makes the example selection also very granular. So you can keep picking multiple examples until they cover all the properties that the system predicts. And then I'll share one final optimization here. So in this case, if you want to go from the natural language on the left to the code snippet on the right side, picking the example that I have in my example bank, the best example still does not help me, because the example does not really tell me that the third argument actually corresponds to the count. But I know which method is important. So now I can go and look into the documentation to get more information about this method, which actually also talks about the third argument. And when I additionally pass in this documentation to the model, it is actually able to do the right job. So I have one other trick for enhancing prompt engineering, but I guess I'm running out of time, so I'll skip this part. But at a very high level, this is about using the model itself to refine its own prompt instructions after having it to self-reflect on its failures. Now, we have seen natural language as a very important modality for describing users' intent. But turns out that natural language is also an interesting modality for output, because one very common use of large language models is even not as much as generating programs, but to explaining programs. We also saw the use case of hint generation. And then one important question that arises is, what constitutes a good explanation or hint? In fact, natural language is also an important modality for conversing with the user to resolve the ambiguity. And here it is important to understand what constitutes a good conversation with the user, because if you can do that, then we can also try to improve that quality. And here our key insight was to look into principles of effective communication in social sciences literature. And we figured out these Grissian maxims of communication. And when we encode this kind of information in the prompts, we actually see that the quality of communication with the user actually goes quite up. And it is these kinds of maxims that you can also use to evaluate the quality of the communication. And in fact, one of the most interesting aspects of using natural language as conversation is to design these multi-agent workflows. where this conversation or this natural language is used to describe a plan as to how to solve a given problem, and even to generate a review of the output of an LLM. This is the most happening area in the world of AI these days. You know, I did not have time to get into this. This is a completely separate topic of its own accord. But the most interesting aspect about this is that now you're not writing one prompt. What you're doing is you're writing multiple different prompts, one for planning, one for reviewing, and so forth. And now if prompting is what, you know, becomes our new programming paradigm, or at least, you know, AI programming paradigm, then we saw some instances of how to actually construct such prompts in the first place. But one big opportunity that we have is also on how to maintain these prompts. And this is the opportunity to define the software engineering equivalent in this new programming paradigm. For instance, what parts of a prompt are really leading to a given buggy behavior? Or if I were to change this part of the prompt, which tests are likely to break? Okay, so now let me conclude. So the number one idea I wanted to share in this talk was around building neurosymbolic systems. Now, the symbolic logical reasoning based techniques are the ones that can give you validation and correctness. But the big challenge there is that they require very domain specific investments. On the other hand, LLMs have very broad applicability, and I believe their combination can be potent. Now, one way to combine them is to use a neural model first, for instance, to figure out the examples, and then they use the symbolic model to generate the program from those examples. Or you can even use them the other way around. But you can also combine them in more intricate ways. So the way I showed you how the programming by example architecture of FlashField works, where models can actually be used to provide hints about which path in the search to explore, or even for ranking. And it can even be the other way around, where the symbolic model actually provides hint to the neural model, which we saw in the execution guided search. In fact, this is a talk that I would highly recommend for you to watch. It was given by Noam Brown at UW a few days ago, where he talks about the importance of search at inference time and our ability to generate such trajectories can actually be used to fine-tune the underlying models in the first place. And then the second final idea I wanted to leave you with is that there are many different forms of expressing intent, which might be more natural than natural language in respective settings. You know, examples being one of them. And sometimes the user's intent is also hidden inside the temporal context, as I showed you. And user interactivity is key to enabling reliability and correctness for sophisticated long-running tasks. And here I showed you this investigate and respond agentic pattern, which really prompted when should LLM be talking to the user, and the Grissian maxims of communication, which talk about how to interact with the user. So I will stop here. This is my final summary slide and would be happy to take on any questions.
Thank you so much, Sumit. I certainly super enjoyed your talk. And I am so jealous that you found a way of explaining to your father what you did. This is so powerful to all of us. I with my PhD thesis in operating system, I really struggled to get a way of communicating. And I was so very inspired by the origin story for Flash. But, you know, you're trying to solve a problem from a real user. So thank you. Thank you for that. We have here a few questions. The first one will exercise your guessing of context, because the question came at the middle of the talk when I noticed, it could be a few minutes after it, it was when you were talking about repetitive tasks that users do and learning from it, and you motivated all of us to look at accessibility as another dimension that we should communicate. So it was on that part of the talk. But the question, and I'll read, is how could this technology be transferable to emergency services? So if something comes, you tell us, otherwise we can just wait for the person can now ask now a little more generically. But anything about applying the pieces of reduction of repetitive work to emergent service? Anything comes to mind?
Yes. So I would say that temporal context is one aspect that is today missing from the data that these large language models have been trained on. So these large language models have been trained on a snapshot of the world that exists at a given point of time. And there is a lot of value in leveraging the signals that have happened before. Now, these signals can be of two different kinds. One is for the very specific instance that you are trying to solve, whereas I showed that if you want to edit code, it would be good to see what other edits you have done in the very recent past. But this kind of temporal context scales beyond that as well. And this gets you into the category of personalization. Of the AI model, knowing more about you, how you have done things in the past, maybe even how have other users, you know, done things in the past. And that I also believe is going to be one of the next, you know, big AI frontiers. So I don't know the details, you know, of the application that you have in mind, but I'm absolutely confident that temporal context is the key, either for making the current instance more effective or from this space of personalization. And our opportunity to get there would be to collect this kind of data, which has this temporal aspect, and then use it to train foundational models with this kind of data or to fine-tune existing models.
Okay, very good. The second question came when you were talking about Visual Studio supporting debugging of helping the user to debug. So it was about Copilot providing fixes for the users. And the question is that these techniques can be applied, if these techniques can be applied to across many domains of programming language, procedural, functional, object-oriented, scripting, and logic programming language. For instance, the person who asked the question has been converting Python and Perl code into Rust. Are similar constructs available in Rust for each of these language types? So that kind of transformation.
Yes. So I'll break down that question into two parts. One is, what would it take to do a more effective job on different kinds of debugging problems? And the second question would be about the specific migration scenario that you might be interested in. So on the first part, what I focused on was the importance of letting the LLM figure out more information if it believes that it does not have the right information to answer the question. And when it figures out more information, it can either use the tools that are made available to it, such as look at the results of a program analysis or look at the errors in a given watch window. Or it can go back to the user and ask them some more details that are not evident to the LLM, even from the context. In fact, you know, I think of it, another analogy that I have is, you know, what happens in a courtroom. When the judge is presented with the various facts, the judge does not announce a decision immediately. The judge investigates. When they get one piece of investigation, then based upon that, they might actually investigate even more and figure out more questions until they feel confident that they have all the right information, then to be able to pass on the judgment. And it's very important to be able to make the retrieval of this information iterative and also involve the user in doing this, right? So this is what I focused on. Now, what I did not talk about was that, of course, you know, there are some other domain specific aspects that are very important. So one aspect was, how do users themselves go about doing this kind of debugging and fixes? And that workflow that they use is also important to capture in this process. So one thing that we captured at a very high level was that in order to suggest a fix, you first need to localize. So if you look at the entire literature on program repair, you will see that one of the first pillars there is that you need to first understand what the issue is, then localize where the bug might be, and then suggest a repair. So we would incorporate this kind of generic workflow also into our agentic architecture. And now you can start making it more specific. So if you're looking at functional languages or declarative languages and so on, it would be good to do some case study or some understanding of how do typical developers go about fixing these bugs and see if you can encode that process inside this agentic architecture that I showed you, right? So I talked about very general terms, but there's definitely opportunity for you to specialize these agentic architectures to incorporate the workflows that humans have. So that's one. But the other specific, the second part, that I would make out of your question is for the very specific application of migration, such as you want to convert C to Rust, or you want to migrate your code from an old version of Java to a new version of Java, or from an old version of .NET to a new version of .NET. So these are very sophisticated tasks, longer running tasks, might take months, for people to actually do. Right? In fact, a lot of work today runs on COBOL, because that's verified software, right? Our airplanes and so on. It would take quite an effort to modernize these things. And now with the power of LLMs, we can start, dreaming and thinking about this kind of software debt that we have in the society. And the most important thing I would say here is involving the user. So when you have a sophisticated and longer running task, errors at each step are continuing to get multiplied, and you will end up with completely wrong translations, or the system might get stuck in a completely wrong path. So it is very important to involve user in the process in this agentic workflows. It is very important to be able to backtrack, to employ some kind of search, and it is very important to have some kind of validation and verification loops as well. This is probably the place where you can bring on, some of our work in the space of program analysis and verification. This is also the place where these logical reasoning based techniques can actually be combined, with these neural techniques. So this is probably the most happening thing that is in the world of AI today, is multi-agents. And if you're interested to learn more, you can actually watch out for the leaderboard on the SWEEbench benchmark. So that's one place where many organizations are competing against trying to solve these sophisticated software engineering tasks.
Okay. So the next question comes from Greg Hager. He's the lead here at Size, in other words, my boss. And Greg says, very interesting work and examples. One question he has is how this will evolve as language models evolve. For example, an updated LLM may produce different outputs, for example, than its potentially weaker predecessor. Do you have any ideas on how we managing versioning of hints and prompts in the underlying LLM-based technology itself?
Yes. So that's a great question. And at a philosophical level, what I'm continuing to tell myself and make my choices as I pick up problems to solve is to be very intentional about picking problems where you're not facing these headwinds. You think that there's a problem with the models, you work on some problem, only to figure out that your work is no longer relevant because a new version of the model does not need that. It already, solves that problem. You want to be picking up problems where you have tailwinds. So maybe you have a solution that does not work very well today, but your approach likely stands a test of time. And then as models evolve, your solution just automatically keeps getting better. So it's easier said than done, because this is a constant, worry on my mind as we continue to do our own research in this space. Now, more directly answering your question, one of the problems that we have inside releasing these technologies inside real products is exactly around this model migration. So we spend a lot of time, at least inside Microsoft, to deal with issues like responsible AI, making sure there are no security issues and so forth. And we also want to make sure that we are able to use the best of the models. So when new models come in, we want to migrate to those models. And invariably what happens is that all of your benchmarking that you have suddenly breaks down as soon as the model switch happens. And this is a place where you need to now rethink your prompts. So today, I would say the prompting is still a very flaky business. I touched a little bit upon it when I talked about prompt maintenance. And one of the places where it hits us hard is actually when model migration happens, when you have to migrate to a different model. It might be a more powerful model, but the way you wrote the prompt may not be very effective, and you might get worse performance. So now you are in a situation where you have to figure out how to update the prompt so that you get better performance with the new model. And this is the opportunity for us to build, you know, some good software engineering practices here. You might have a huge benchmark, but then now, if you make a small change to the prompt, if you have to run through your entire benchmark, it's very expensive, also very time consuming. How can you get some kind of quick feedback as to what part of the prompt should you change in order to fix this regression issue? Or if you were to change this part of the prompt, what tests might possibly break? And one interesting idea in this front might be to look at the attention mechanism of these models. So if you can get heat map of what aspects of the prompt is the model paying more attention to when it tries to do a certain kind of task, then it might give you some hints on which parts of the tests are more sensitive to which parts of the prompt. And this kind of stuff might help you do more agile software engineering. Maybe some of these problems will go away once we get to even better and better models where these models are not as flaky with respect to how we write prompts. But today, this is not the case. And I say that this is a big opportunity for us to think about our software engineering in this new world of prompting.
Okay, thank you. You know, we have comments from the audience about being a brilliant session, excellent responses and insightful presentation. We also have a question. How can we ensure fairness of metadata for any model? Are we following fair principles?
So Dilma did not get the question. Fairness of what?
Fairness of metadata.
I see.
How can we ensure fairness of metadata for any model? And then are we following fair principles?
So I feel that fairness can be built at different layers. So one is that these innovations, as they keep happening around in the world, you know, companies like, you know, big companies like OpenAI are constantly watching which of these techniques is successful and that becomes actually part of the model itself. So that is one layer that you actually get. The second layer where you can incorporate any of these responsible AI concerns would be in trying to develop some kind of filter when the user's query comes in. So that would be the second layer of defense that you can put in. And then the third layer of defense would be once the output is actually generated. So again, the answer to this, you know, will be very specific for different kinds of domains where you're looking for these responsible AI aspects, which I believe are extremely important. And but generic answer that I can give is that there are three different layers where you can where this can be affected. Right, one is probably out of your control, which is the companies, organizations that actually develop these models, so they take care of it. Thing that are in your control is to put a filter when the user's input comes in and the query comes in, and then you can decide how you want to transform, if at all, before passing into the model. And then the third layer of defense would be when the output comes out, and then you're figuring out whether it meets the responsible AI criterion or not. Now, to evaluate whether it meets the responsible AI criteria or not, or to develop these filters that I'm talking about, especially in the when the user's query comes in or when the output from the model comes in, you can itself use LLM also, right? So there's a lot of work that is going on in even training these LLMs to be able to pass a judgment on responsible AI aspects.
Okay, we only have now 1 minute, but there is a very interesting question. I'll read it. You probably won't have time to really go into detail, but it is about incorporating AI models into code that the code itself may be stochastic. So when you're doing that in the programming process, so one example, you're using a computer vision model in an application where the computer vision model itself may not always provide correct output, and which itself may be evolving its capabilities over time.
Yes, so a very fascinating observation. And what I will say is that in this new world of AI programming, the best perspective that you can take is that you have a very powerful piece of technology at hand, which is these, you know, large language models. but they are not a very reliable form of computation. So very powerful, but not 100% reliable and approximately correct. And this is a place where I feel neurosymbolic methods hold the key to doing things. So if you are able to evaluate the quality of the output of a given call to the large language model, if you are able to reflect on it, and this can become the basis of doing some kind of search and backtracking. So in domains where you have the generator verification gap, you know, this is a slide that I showed you, the YouTube slide, the talk from this OpenAI researcher that was given at UW, actually goes into this phenomenon. That whenever you have a domain where validation is relatively easy compared to generation, you have a very interesting situation to do search and backtracking and reflection on whether it was correct or not. But neurosymbolic solutions, you know, would be the key there, and search and backtracking.
Very good. Thank you so much for the fascinating talk. We're really very grateful. For the NSF people around in the talk, we will be have the opportunity to talk more to Dr. Sumit Gowani in 15 minutes. But for the rest of the audience, thank you for being here. Thank you so much, Sumit. And you should be hearing the big claps coming, you know, from all people watching. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you, everyone, for the wonderful questions. I really enjoyed this interaction. And thanks, Ilma, for the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Bye.
Bye.